Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The collapse of a factory in Bangladesh that killed more than 1,000 workers caused a flurry of outrage and widespread calls for sweatshop reforms. But so did the fire 4 months earlier that killed more than 100 workers at another Bangladesh garment factory. This disaster, however, may be different. After all, the April 24th building collapse caused the biggest death toll in the history of the garment industry. The Bangladesh government says it will raise the minimum wage for garment workers and allow them to form trade unions without permission from factory owners. And Bangladesh has pledged to work with the International Labor Organization to establish and enforce minimum labor standards. Also this month, nearly 36 European retailers signed a legally binding agreement to improve the safety of garment factories in Bangladesh. However, the major U.S. retailers refused to join the effort. And if improved conditions lead to higher wages, will retailers just move to another poor country with workers willing to work for pennies an hour? Today on Global Journalist, I'll speak to a workers' rights advocate and a Bloomberg News reporter who covers the industry. We'll talk about the long-term impact this unprecedented disaster could have on the low-cost garment industry. But first, World Watch. There are developments in two of the countries we've been covering on Global Journalist, Syria and Cuba. Syrian President Bashar Assad says the government has received the first shipment of Russian-made anti-aircraft missiles. In another dose of bad news today, the primary Western-backed opposition group says it will not participate in peace talks. The developments could increase tensions in the region and undermine efforts to hold peace talks. Cuba's most famous dissident blogger is returning to the island today from a prolonged global tour, but Yeoni Sanchez doesn't know if the future could bring more trouble or more influence. The communist-led island has never looked kindly on dissent, but the authorities allowed Sanchez and several lesser-known opposition figures to travel as part of a landmark migration reform that took effect in January. They eliminated exit visa requirements for all Cubans. Sanchez has taken advantage of the newfound freedom by visiting more than a dozen countries since her trip began in February. She toured the White House. She made speeches before European and Latin American parliamentarians, and she exchanged ideas with luminaries as diverse as Polish President Lech Walesa and Cuban-American musician Emilio Estefan. Sanchez won fame with searing social commentary in her Generation Y blog. In a steady stream of tweets, she's been writing about plans to start an independent online newspaper when she returns. That could put the 37-year-old on a collision course with the government of President Raul Castro. Sanchez's return also presents challenges for the government. Its treatment of her is sure to receive close scrutiny from journalists, foreign governments, and human rights organizations. That's it for World Watch. 2 months before the Rana Plaza building collapse in Bangladesh, Bloomberg reporter Renee Dudley co-wrote an article focusing on the unsafe conditions in the country's garment factories. And Charlie Kernighan, who directs the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, has been fighting against sweatshop labor practices for nearly 30 years. Renee is joining us from Boston, and Charlie is on the line from Pittsburgh. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hey,
good to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Let's start with a general assessment. Elizabeth Klein, an investigative reporter who wrote a book on the garment factories in Bangladesh and China, said in a public radio interview this month that she's, quote, 100% convinced that this is the turning point. So Charlie, what percentage would you put on the chances for substantial changes in the garment industry?
Well, maybe about 60%, maybe 65%, because we agree. This is a turning point, this tragedy. The Rana Plaza collapse of 1,127 people who were killed needlessly. However, Bangladesh is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It's hollowed out with bribery and graft. Mm-hmm. So you can't really put all your money on the fact that we think that they will finally clean up this horrible sweatshop conditions, these horrible sweatshop conditions for the garment workers. But right. everyone is going to push in that direction, but I don't think it's a done deal.
And Renee, what are your thoughts overall?
Well, you know, a number of people after Tazreen, the factory that burned in November, thought that was going to be a flashpoint, and there's been this this, you know, international agreement that various labor monitoring groups have been mm-hmm. pushing for a couple of years now, and Tazreen, you know, didn't get it over the hump, but Rana Plaza did in mm-hmm. terms of getting, you know, a minimum number of retailers to sign on to it so that it would go into effect.
Right.
So that's one sign, but, you know, I have to agree with Charlie that there's, you know, significant corruption in Bangladesh. You know, a number of politicians are also factory owners. So, you know, inside the country, you know, you can expect, I guess, them to look out for their interests.
And Charlie, you're getting ready to go to Bangladesh. Tell us about what you're going to be doing there.
Well, yes, and just to point out that the owner of the Tazreen factory, where the 112 workers were uh-huh. killed, he's walking around scot-free. He's not in any
right.
prison or anything like that. So it was only the magnitude of the Rana Plaza that really forced the government to finally crack down.
Mm-hmm.
We're focused a lot on worker rights. And in Bangladesh for the last 30 years, there are no labor rights. And so the large multinationals, the Walmarts, the Gaps, and others, they've really been feeding off of, like, starvation wages, 12-cent wages, 12 cents an hour, 22 cents an hour, you know, 14-hour shifts, 7 days a week, 2 days off a month maybe, working 90 to 100 hours a week, being cheated of their overtime pay, kids working in many of these factories still, especially in the two-tier level, mm-hmm. Second-tier level garment factories. There's enormous mm-hmm. amount of work that needs to be done, but the missing piece for the workers has all along been the right to organize.
Yeah.
And Bangladesh does not allow the right to organize. As a matter of fact, the Bangladesh Export Processing Zone Authority, called BEPSA, is run by former military people in Bangladesh, and they themselves maintain blacklists mm-hmm. so that any worker who asks for their rights in these export processing zones, that those workers will be blacklisted. They will never, ever, ever work again in the export processing zones. And on top of it, when we were there last year in Bangladesh, there was a big fight in Rosita and Megatex, two big factories that were owned by European companies that were producing for European companies. The military people and the BEPSA people and the government of Bangladesh actually threatened to kill the union leaders if they didn't stop promoting their union. So now we're hoping that this horrible tragedy of the Rana Plaza collapse will finally push the government to adhere to the ILO labor standards. But
right.
again, it's not a done deal, but that's the goal.
And Renee, do you think that that the government is just paying lip service to this, or they'll actually fulfill their promise to let workers join unions without permission?
Well, Charlie would know more about the labor side than I would, but part of what makes this so difficult is that Bangladesh relies on the garment industry.
Right.
I mean, it's the driver of its economy there. Garments are its primary export.
Yeah, 80%, right?
So they need this industry, and they need Western retailers to stay there.
Right.
So part of the problem, you know, thus far has been they've made it as easy as possible to accommodate Western retailers.
And that's why they flock there,
you know,
right?
In some cases, that's led to, you know, some of these safety issues. You know, the mm-hmm. the Walmarts, the Gaps of the world, you know, operate. And the garment industry is fairly thin margins, and you know they rely on being able to get the absolute lowest cost garments possible. And, you know, in Bangladesh, they try to deliver that because they've come to rely on that as their mm-hmm. economic lifeblood.
Right. And this plan devised by retailers, union leaders, and government officials is officially called the Accord on Factory and Building Safety in Bangladesh. Renee, what's in this agreement?
Yeah, so this has been under, you know, a version of it has been under consideration since 2011, almost to the, you know, it was first discussed almost to the day of the Rana Plaza collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, essentially, you know, this would require retailers to pay overseas factories, higher wages so that they could afford some of the, you know, higher costs for their garments, so that the factories could afford some of the necessary safety upgrades, things as basic as fire escapes, sprinkler systems, very basic things.
Mm-hmm.
It would also, put into place some, independent monitoring. That's to say, auditors selected by the monitoring groups rather than the retailers themselves, and it would create some transparency in, you know, the audit process and the supply chain.
So why did the U.S. retailers decline to sign on then? It sounds reasonable.
Yeah. So what happened was this thing had initially needed 4 retailers to sign on. So over the past 2 years, they've gotten 2, PVH, which is the parent company of Tommy Hilfiger, and a German retailer. So after Rana Plaza, we're basically talking about the same document that's been under consideration this whole time. H&M signed on, and then Inditex, which is the parent company of Zara, and then a bunch of other European retailers, fell like dominoes, followed suit, and, agreed this was the way to go. Walmart and Gap, amongst other U.S. retailers, declined to sign on. And, they say that they have their own systems in place, that they've bulked up, and they find that satisfactory. The labor monitoring groups would say that that's not satisfactory. The retailers think that there's they object to the fact that this would be a legally binding contract.
They're worried about lawsuits, right?
And that's where they've left it.
Yeah, I heard that they're worried about lawsuits because they think that this country is more litigious than some of the European countries.
Yeah, that's been part of it.
Right. And both of you, Charlie, first, can this work without the United States being involved?
No, it can, and I think it really is one of the home runs, like if they can keep pushing this. And, of course, it's driven mostly, like Rennie said, by the European Union owners and garment factory manufacturers. Precious few, just like the PVH and Abercrombie and Fitch.
Yeah.
But the health and safety, the building safety and the fire safety, this thing's a home run, and eventually it's going to work. Walmart is always out of it. As a matter of fact, we've just discovered a factory called Mondi,
mm-hmm.
and in Bangladesh and Dhaka, and they were being 1 million. Walmart boxer shorts were being sewn in the factory, and Walmart had no idea that they had 1 million garments in that factory. I mean, they're just out of it, and they'll do everything to drag down laws, regulations. So we just have to expect that. But the European Union's going to go forward, and gradually some decent U.S. companies will probably come forward. What's missing is the rights of workers. This is not this health and safety accord does not guarantee workers the right to organize and to bargain collectively and to, run independent unions and not be beaten and starved. So this is a whole other aspect.
Right. And Renee, what are your thoughts? Does this give U.S. Based retailers an edge if they can kind of just glom on to the improvements in Bangladesh?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. There's a couple things here. So first of all, H&M is one of the biggest buyers from Bangladesh, so the fact that they're on is significant. But that's a good point, and I think we're going to see more in the coming weeks, months about this. So the labor monitoring groups say, and the retailers, have acknowledged that they oftentimes use the same factories. I mean, we're not talking about, like, you know, five or six huge factories. We're talking about thousands of small factories. You know, it doesn't take much to set up. This is not like, you know, Foxconn, Apple, this is, you know, people with a sewing machine. So it doesn't take a whole lot to start it up. And my question was, you know, so if H&M and Inditex and all the rest are paying for these upgrades and they're all using the same factories, then, you know, do the likes of Gap and Walmart get the advantage without having to pay the cost?
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not sure what's going to happen there. I haven't heard all, you know, I think that this is also new, and the details of the agreement are still sort of, you know, it's in the implementation phase, and, you know, I don't think that, you know, that's sort of played out yet.
Right. Let's, I flipped through some of my shirts and pants hanging in my closet this morning to read the labels, and they were surprisingly made from probably a dozen different countries in Asia and Central America. What can consumers do to support these reform efforts?
You know, that's an interesting question too. So, you know, what you said is true. You know, so retailers had originally, you know, been in China and, you know, other countries in Southeast Asia, and then when wages started to rise there, they go for the next country, basically. Like I said, it's easy enough to set up a factory, and Bangladesh was it. You know, we'd been writing about sort of, you know, the influence of fast fashion in all of this. And, you know, a lot of the retailers will say that consumers have such a demand for a constant turnover of merchandise, for new styles, for, you know, to be able to go into, you know, Target or, you know, wherever and see new clothes every time. And that's really dependent on a flexible supply chain. So in other words, these retailers that turn out, you know, that have, you know, a big selection, so, you know, both a ton of styles and a constant turnover of styles, they rely on being able to have factories that can churn this stuff out, you know, on a dime and, you know, deal with late changes to orders and with being able to do a variety of different styles, you know, things as simple as pocket placement. You know, if Walmart, for example, sees that, you know, shorts with a certain zipper aren't selling as well as others, they'll have their factory go back and scrap that zipper, we're going with this. And the factory is covering the costs of that.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems like sort of like the drug situation. We're addicted to cheap clothes, and the demand is causing problems throughout the world. Is that, that the way you see it, Charlie?
Yes, especially from the perspective of the workers. Don't forget, when they're going through this production and constantly refining production and changing styles, you're talking about workers working from 8 o'clock in the morning until 10:30 at night or 11 o'clock and working 7 days a week with a one-hour break, cheated of their overtime pay, beaten, yelled at, screamed at, can't use the bathrooms. I mean, in other words, the real misery is inside the factories with the workers. And as far as monitoring goes, corporate monitoring, it never works. And I was interested in an article that John Ruggie spoke about in 2009. He's the special representative for the United Nations Secretary General of Human Rights and Transnational Corporations and other businesses. And this is what he said, quote, "Just about everybody, at least off the record, will tell you that monitoring doesn't work and auditing of supplier factories doesn't work because people cheat." So in my in our experience in Bangladesh and many other countries, these corporate codes of conduct never work, and in fact, they're designed not to work. And that's why we introduced legislation in the House and in the Senate of the United States in 2007 We had 27 members of the Senate endorse the Decent Working Conditions and Fair Competition Act, which for the first time ever, along with 177 members of the House, they introduced a bill saying that you can bring your garments or products from anywhere in the world. You can bring them into the United States. You can sell them in the United States. You can export them. You can do whatever you want. But you're not going to be allowed to sell these garments, these products, or export them or import if they're made by children, if they're made by forced labor, and if the workers are denied their ILO labor standards, which is the right to organize, the right to organize a union, the right to collective bargaining and decent working conditions. We're not setting wages. Wages are set by countries across the world. We're not going to be doing anything like that. But we need to have enforceable laws. If workers' rights are to be protected in the global sweatshop economy, we need enforceable laws to protect the workers at least as much as the labels.
Right. And
because the labels themselves have laws, the intellectual property and copyright laws. You cannot make a knockoff of Gap. You'll go to jail. So the label's protected, but not the human being. It's, it's a failed system.
And Charles or Renee, do you think this terrible disaster in Bangladesh is will increase the support behind this legislative initiative in Congress?
Yeah, well, I don't know all too much about the congressional legislation. I'm not sure if there's anything more recent than 2007. But ripping off of what Charlie said before about the the inspections don't work, a key part of this problem is that oftentimes orders get subcontracted out to what are called unauthorized factories. So the retailer, Walmart, will think that its goods are being produced at such and such a factory. But in fact, that factory has too much work. They can't handle everything. They know they're under pressure because if they don't get their order in on time, they're never going to get a contract again, right? So they subcontract it out to factories that are sometimes, even worse, or, with no standards whatsoever, that work around the clock, that don't have any fire. And they're not monitored at all, because, as far as the retailer knows, that factory is not even in use. And that's what we saw with Walmart in Tazreen. They said that was an unauthorized factory, that it wasn't supposed to be, doing anything for them. But, time and time again, we see that these unauthorized factories are being used. And it goes back to the fast fashion element. The factories know that they have to turn out all of their merchandise on time, or they risk not getting another contract, and this is how they achieve it.
Right, and I wanted to expand on other countries outside of Bangladesh, but before we continue, I want to remind everyone that you can listen to Global Journalist anytime by downloading our podcasts from the website globaljournalist.org. Our website also features stories related to the contents of our programs, so please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Charlie, are there unintended consequences here possibly if all the attention is drawn on Bangladesh and they institute some reforms and the costs of wages go up and companies like Walmart decide, okay, we're going to make our clothes in some other country that doesn't have all these regulations, and then these poor people in Bangladesh will have no jobs instead of bad jobs.
Yes, it just won't happen because the wages are the lowest wages in the world, and the Bangladeshis are some of the hardest workers in the world, also the least paid and the least rights. But just as an aside with Walmart, though, I can't imagine that the largest retailer in the world, if they put their mind to it and if they enforced it, I can't believe that they wouldn't know where their garments were in these particular factories. I think they actually, slack off so that they can get these garments made under illegal subcontracts, because we see it all the time. A company of their stature and size should be able to crack the whip and should have a handle on what factories they're producing. And I think it's sort of like just turning their head away and allowing it to be put in these illegal sweatshops. But it basically, you can't get lower than Bangladesh. We see no indication whatsoever of factories pulling out. I think more this is going to continue. Bangladesh said before the tragedy, before the killings of the 112 workers at Rana Plaza, they said they would double within the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. They would double the number of garment workers and the amount of garment exports that they would make. You have about 4.5 million garment workers now, and maybe about $18 to $20 billion a year in exports. They're bringing it up way. They're bringing it up to like 50 million, and they're going to double the number of workers. So I don't think Bangladesh is going to get hit.
Yeah.
People are going to stop pulling out.
Yeah, Renee, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, no major retailers have said that they're going to be pulling out of Bangladesh. And Charlie said you can't get lower than Bangladesh in terms of wages. I would say you can't get lower than Bangladesh now in terms of wages. I mean, certainly it's among the lowest. But I have heard some chatter, you know, that there's always a new frontier, you know, in
yeah.
terms of finding cheap labor. I mean. Not that we've seen a big move yet, but a couple of people have mentioned Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Since retailers are always looking for the lowest cost, you know, they'll always be on the lookout for a new destination.
Right. And we've been talking about the low-cost garment industry with Renee Dudley, a Bloomberg News reporter, and Charlie Kernighan, director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. Thank you both for joining us with this very illuminating discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Stay with us for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Global Journalist's Free Press Watch. This week's news concerning media freedom comes out of Syria, Uruguay, and the United States. One journalist was killed at the Syrian-Lebanese border, according to Syrian State TV. Yara Abbas was a reporter working for pro-Al-Assad state television and was targeted by a Free Syrian Army sniper and is now being called a martyr. Activists say the area has been experiencing heavy fighting, with 40 regime shells being dropped per minute. The South American country of Uruguay will be considering a new communications law similar to that of Argentina. Parts of the law will limit the chance for media monopolies to form, similar to what is happening in the United States. Another part will establish an enforcement body similar to the FCC. These regulations have met criticism from local and international free press advocates. Talam, the Argentine press agency, reported President José Mujica of Uruguay sent a draft of the Audiovisual Services and Communications Law to Congress last week. In Louisiana, a new state law could make it illegal to publish any personal information about concealed handgun permit holders, and only needs approval from a conference committee after some changes were suggested by the Senate. The law is one step from Governor Bobby Jindal's desk to receive his signature, which would prevent any publication of the information contained on an application for the permit, and anyone who breaks this law could face 6 months in jail and a $10,000 fine, according to the New Orleans Times-Picayune. In addition to journalist punishment, any police officer who gives away this information to a reporter could be fined $500 and also serve 6 months in jail. Many fear the precedent this law may set, dampening First Amendment protection for the Second Amendment. For more information about these events and others involving independence of the press around the world, visit our website, globaljournalist.org. I'm Allie McIntyre.